This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here is what's coming up.
Niger is a linchpin right now towards stability in the Sahel, and it has done significantly better than its neighbors.
That was Joseph Sigo, Director of Research at the African Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, creating democracy for Niger's role as an island of stability in the Sahel region. Also, one focus in Nigeria's elections tomorrow is on how women candidates fare. Mozambique says a cholera outbreak from Cyclone Freddy killed 8 people and hospitalized 250. And mourners pay respects to Ghanaian football star Christian Atsu, who died in the Turkey-Syria quake. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is the first top U.S. diplomat to visit Niger, as the West African country has emerged as a crucial security base for Western countries seeking to counter terrorism groups in the Sahel region. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Terrorist organizations like Boko Haram and Islamic State and branches of Al-Qaeda continue to pose a threat to Niger and governments across sub-Saharan Africa. This is the aftermath of an attack last week in neighboring Nigeria, where militants in Borno State killed at least 37 fishermen. Amid regional security concerns, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken chose to visit Niger. In a joint news conference with his Nigerian counterpart in Niamey, Blinken announced nearly $150 million in humanitarian assistance to help meet the tremendous need in Western and Central Africa and the Sahel created by regional instability. Blinken had this to say on the scourge of extremist violence.
We are also supporting investments in the long-term security of Niger, investments that you heard the minister refer to, help make Niger's law enforcement more effective in combating terrorism, strengthening border security, enhancing counter-narcotics capacity, stemming trafficking, helping to investigate, prosecute, and ultimately reduce terrorism, violent extremism.
During the visit, Blinken highlighted Niger's democratic government and its efforts to help its young people break free from the pull of extremist groups. One expert told VOA he was not surprised that Blinken had decided to visit Niger after his visit to Ethiopia. Joseph Siegel is director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, National Defense University. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
Again, Niger is a linchpin right now towards stability in the Sahel. And it has done significantly better than its neighbors. It has a more democratic government. Remember that in Mali and Burkina Faso, we've seen military coups. And so you have great governance turmoil in those countries. Niger is an island of stability in comparison.
Niger is one of the world's poorest countries and desperately needs more humanitarian aid to help nurses, like this one in the remote northern village of Sulufeta, who have no equipment and no drugs to treat patients. Blinken said the new fund for Central Africa will provide for shelter, food, safe drinking water, and sanitation, while also supporting vulnerable refugees and asylum seekers evacuated to Niger from neighboring countries. Blinken praised the people of Niger's generosity for taking in refugees. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Many are watching Nigeria's gubernatorial and state assembly elections tomorrow to see how women candidates fare. The number of women elected to the National Assembly dropped by half in a February 25th vote in what activists say is a step backward for women facing cultural bias in politics. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Juliet Isi Ikayere unanimously won her party's vote to contest the National Assembly elections last month. The 28-year-old lawyer says she joined politics in 2021 after supporting protests against police brutality and bad governance. But out of 360 National Assembly seats, women won only 12, and Ikayere wasn't one of them. She blames gender inequality and a lack of access to campaign funds.
The political terrain in Nigeria is usually faced with violence. It's more of a patriarchal society whereby for a woman to even talk, she needs to have somebody who actually give her access, inroads in these political parties.
Nigeria is Africa's biggest democracy, and women represent half of its total population. But they occupy only 4% of politically elected positions, despite succeeding in business and private sectors. Nigeria has never had a female president or vice president since returning to democracy in 1999, and a woman has yet to be elected governor of any state. Cynthia Mbamalu is a director of programs at Yaga Africa, a non-profit promoting democratic governance.
So they say politics is local, and our local context is driven by patriarchal norms, religious and traditional or cultural sentiments, which do not favor women political leadership.
The UN says Nigeria has the lowest representation of women in politics across all of Africa. Ireti Kingibe is one of just three female senators elected on February 25th, compared to eight women who won Senate seats in 2019. Kingibe defeated a male counterpart who had been in office since 2011.
Women have to be allowed to emerge. And I'm beginning to think that unless we legislate it, we're never going to get the parties to agree that women are an integral and critical part of our society. There's a certain attitude of the men in the party, even when they know a lot less than you have been in the political space.
Last year, Nigerian women protested for weeks at the National Assembly, demanding lawmakers pass five gender-related bills, including one that would reserve 35% of seats in parliament for women. But the bills failed to advance after some lawmakers initially called them ridiculous. Cynthia Mbamalu was one of the protest organizers.
The numbers for women is really saddening, and we're literally, at this point, we should be calling a national emergency on women political inclusion.
Many will be waiting to see if any woman get elected in Saturday's gubernatorial and state assembly elections. 24 women are running for state governor seats. If one wins her election, she will become Nigeria's first female governor. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Mozambique's health minister says a cholera outbreak in the area hit by Cyclone Freddy killed 8 people this week and hospitalized 250, part of 600 sickened since the record storm made landfall in February. Charles Mangwiro reports from Maputo, Mozambique.
Health Minister Armindo Tiago told state-run Radio Mozambique Friday the cholera victims were in the port city of Kilimani, capital of Zambezia province, the area most affected by the cyclone. Tiago said cholera prevention was focused on 133 centers in the city that are sheltering up to 50,000 people displaced by flooding. He said more work was also needed in other provinces hit by Cyclone Freddy, a record cyclone that has been hammering the region since February. He says they must ensure compliance with cholera prevention measures such as boiling drinking water, cleaning and washing food, and disposing of garbage properly, especially human waste. Tiago says when there are symptoms such as diarrhea and vomiting, which could be cholera, people must go to health units. He says everyone must work to control the cholera outbreak. The World Health Organization Wednesday confirmed that Mozambique is seeing a rise in cholera cases, while cases are dropping in neighboring Malawi after a record outbreak. The WHO says more than 40,000 cases of cholera were reported this year in Africa, more than half of them in Malawi. Malawi has given out close to 5 million vaccination doses since the outbreak a year ago, but health authorities fear the numbers could spike there and in Mozambique if adequate measures are not taken. Malawi was this week hit the hardest by the cyclone, leaving hundreds dead and spreading dirty flood waters from heavy rains. Although Cyclone Freddy has weakened to a low pressure systems, flood waters could be contaminated with the cholera bacteria. As the cyclone approached the southeast coast of Africa in February, Mozambique vaccinated more than 700,000 people in four provinces deemed at high risk for cholera. But Zambezia province was not among the regions targeted in the WHO partnered vaccine drive. Reuters reported Mozambique on Wednesday received approval for an additional 1.3 million cholera vaccine doses to help control the spread. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Angola's parliament approved today a year-long deployment of up to 500 soldiers to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The move would secure areas where M23 rebels are stationed and protect members of the team tasked with monitoring compliance with NSC's fire agreements. Angolan leader Lourenco has been a key mediator between the rebels and the DRC's army. As its economy struggles, Egyptians are buying lower-end merchandise because inflation is eroding their purchasing power and the country's weakening currency is pushing up prices of imported goods. Some experts blame a big build-up of external debt and lack of investment in projects that generate products for importing. President Abdel Fattah Sisi, however, blamed the Russian-Ukraine conflict for the economic problems when he spoke to a gathering of international leaders. El Abumon, director of North Africa and the Middle East programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace, discussed Egypt's economic woes with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi.
Well, I think that the economic model that Egypt followed in the last few years is at the heart of the problem. Egypt had access to resources in the last 5 to 6 years, but the government in Egypt decided to use most of these resources to rebuild infrastructure. So basically, all the money they had access to was used to build new cities and new infrastructure and all of this, but none of these projects were actually productive. So instead of using the advantage they had to restructure their economy, to implement structural reforms and to push the Egyptian economy to be more productive, they used it in a different way that many experts were basically predicting, that at some point when they will have less access to money, when all these projects will be completed, then the Egyptians will face the reality of not having enough economic growth in the country. And I guess from what I understood from different experts that this is what's happening right now.
But President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi told a gathering of international leaders that the Russia-Ukraine conflict was seriously affecting Egypt's economy, as Egypt buys most of its grain from Russia and Ukraine, and the price of importing wheat for a population of more than 100 million people has gone up drastically. Is that the real reason behind the Egyptian economic crisis?
This was obviously aggravated by the war in Ukraine and by the high prices of energy in some cases, although Egypt exports gas, but they import other types of energy. So all of this basically, and the post-COVID obviously is another element. So all of this basically led to the situation that Egypt is facing today. Honestly, I don't see any way out for Egypt except through structural reforms of the economy. If they don't proceed immediately with structural economic reforms, they will continue to receive assistance from GCC countries or other, you know, World Bank, etc. But all of these will only provide a temporary relief to the economy, but will not address the core issue, as I said, which is the economic model itself. The economic model itself needs to be revisited. And short of this, I don't see any possibility for Egypt to be on a path of recovery and growth and prosperity.
Eli Abuan, director of North Africa and the Middle East program at the U.S. Institute of Peace, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Al-Shanawi. Oh, A choir sings at a ceremony today to honor Ghanaian football star Christian Asu, who was killed in the earthquake in Turkey last month. Thousands of people honored Asu, beloved not only for his 65 appearances for Ghana in international play and his role on English Premier League teams, but also for his charity and humility. The state-assisted funeral was held at the forecourt of the State House in the capital, Accra. Asu will be interred tomorrow in his hometown, Dogoboni. I reached Kelvin Awusu Ansa, a sportscaster at TV3, who was among those who attended the funeral.
It was a very sorrowful day, very difficult day for everyone who was present there at the forecourt of the State House. Right from 6 a.m. when his body was put on the podium in the middle of the State House, the funeral grounds. It was difficult for all who filed past the body right when the go-ahead was given for the final respects to be given to him. Almost every single person who came back from filing past the fire mortal remains of Achu came back with tears. And for the toughest of men, we would have seen on the pitch, like Samuel Osaka, who is the president of the PFAG, John Menta, John Pinto, Augustin Ahinful, all the ex-footballers of the senior national team, they came back with tears. That was a very sad moment for all, very sober reflections for many when the clergy took over. And at least I'm sure whatever transpired today at the forecourt of the State House was a befitting ceremony to finally pay respect to Achu for the many good things that he did. It clearly depicted that, yes, he was the son of the man who was loved so much for the many good things that he did. Once the event started in the morning from the filing pass, it started with Achu's family, immediate family, allowed to file past the body. Later on, his wife and children arrived, and together with the traditional authority, they were allowed to also file past the body. The Ghana National Supporters Union were given that opportunity to file past. The diplomatic call led by the president of the Nana Akufo-Addo and also ex-president John Mahama, who also was present there, filed past before the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association of Ghana, came in to pay their final respects. The Ghana Football Association also had representatives who were also present in there. And former Africa Footballer of the Year, Abedi Ayupele, was present to also pay his final respects to Christian Achu. And it wasn't just him. Former Arsenal footballers Emmanuel Eboué and Emmanuel Adebayo, the Ivorian and Togolese, were also present to also give their final respect to Christian Achu. So it was a very well-organized funeral rite for Achu, who is currently being sent to his hometown for the internment before the second part of the final funeral rite, that is the family gathering, would be there for all other donations to be made to him and the family for 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. That would be a period of 4 hours. To finally finish off with the funeral arrangements for today.
Asu was known as a great footballer, but also he may be remembered for his work for the community.
Well, I think he's done so many things, and we all know how Arms Around a Child managed to liaise with him to provide the needs of orphans with the orphanage across Senior Breko. Also, he catered for some needs for his feeder club, Cheetah FC, with regards to football boots, other football equipment, and other monetary support too. And, you know, he was very much interested in justice. So he joined that is Justice for Crime, for Criminal Investigative Foundation, to make sure, Crime Foundation, to make sure that all prisoners who were in there for crimes that had to be fined, paid by the offenders to be released, he made sure that he paid them. And for all those who were put in for injustice and needed attorneys, to make sure that they got that opportunity to file for appeal and their case reheard, he made sure that he did that.
That was Kelvin Awusu Ansa, a sportscaster at TV3. He spoke with me from Accra, Ghana. Now, Sunny Young joining us live by phone with a look at the Basketball Africa League from the most recent results, the schedule for this weekend's matches, and the top players so far. Hi, Sunny. Good afternoon.
Sporty greetings, Douglas. Let me first send condolences to all our listeners in Ghana after the funeral of Christian Atchu. Truly a man with a tremendous humanitarian spirit. Rest in peace, Christian Atchu.
Yes, indeed. He was a great guy. Sunny, now back to basketball. So what does this weekend schedule look like in Dakar, Senegal?
Douglas, two games in Dakar on Friday. Abidjan Basketball Club is facing defending BAL champion U.S. Monastir, and that will be followed by a game between local favorite AS Douan, based in Dakar, going up against Stade Malien. On Saturday, two more games. Stade Malien will play Rwanda Energy Group, and then in the second game, Kwara Falcons Basketball Club will play AS Douan. The Falcons-Douan contest, Douglas, will be covered by the Voice of America on our English radio. I'll be joined by Mukbil Yabaro for coverage of Falcons AS Douan.
Great. Sunny, can you recap the most recent results? Some of them were very interesting.
In fact, Douglas, the two unbeaten teams right now are Rwanda Energy Group and defending champion U.S. Monastir. Rwanda Energy Group beat AS Douan in its last game 69-55. And U.S. Monastir clipped the wings of the Falcons by a score of 85-75. Both teams looking very good. Rwanda Energy Group through to the BAL playoffs and final in May. So they'll be playing on their home court, Douglas, in Kigali.
Yeah, Sunny, who has been some of the top players so far in the Sahara Conference?
Well, Douglas, two players in particular for Stade Malien. Suleiman Berthe, he has been outstanding in the tournament. He's the leading scorer so far in Basketball Africa League Season 3. He's averaging 27 points a game. And his teammate, Aliou Diarra, also has been outstanding. He's averaging more than 18 points a game. They're both young players, Douglas, and I think they're going to get some contract offers after this competition. They're based in Mali, but I could see a foreign club being interested in those two players.
A lot of potential indeed are there. Now, Sunny, I understand you and Mukbil Yabaro spoke with the top NBA scout in Africa.
Well, on our latest Nothing But Net with Mukbil and Sunny podcast, Douglas, we spoke with Sarah Chan, born in South Sudan, the first woman scout for the NBA in Africa. She works for the Toronto Raptors, and Sarah, very articulate. She talked about her basketball journey as well as gender equity initiatives in the Basketball Africa League and other topics. So I encourage our VOA listeners, check out our Nothing But Net with Mukbil and Sunny podcast. You can follow the Basketball Africa League on voaafrica.com as well as at the Sunny Side of Sports. So check it out. Lots going on and lots to entertain and inform.
Thank you, Sunny. Sport a weekend, Sunny.
Thank you, Douglas.
You're welcome. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.